Hello.
Bob?
Hi.
Hey, that's better.
This is much better, but boy, I am about to throw my iPhone out of the car. I mean, unbelievable. Partly it's that...
This is a little piece of audio that I thought no one would ever hear. It's an outtake from The Jinx that I chuckled about in the edit room literally a decade ago. It's director Andrew Jarecki talking to Robert Durst, at the time a free man. What are they talking about? Bob's new iPhone.
I just can't get used to this touch phone, Andrew. I take the thing out of my pocket and I find I've called somebody.
Yeah, we call that pocket dialing.
Is that what we call it? Anyway, I don't like it.
Hi, I'm Zach Stewart Pontier, one of the filmmakers behind HBO's The Jinx, and I'm thrilled to welcome you to the very first episode of the official Jinx podcast, a show where we take you behind the scenes of Andrew Jarecki's documentary series that became a real-life murder investigation. The Jinx was subtitled The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, and it was 6 episodes that originally aired on HBO back in the spring of 2015. It went on to win multiple awards, an Emmy, TCA Award, and a Peabody. And back then, Andrew and the rest of the team did a bunch of interviews.
The story of Bob Durst was really unusual because he had become notorious over many years.
We also made some behind-the-scenes segments about things like that famous bathroom audio and how we found it.
And he says to himself, there it is, you're caught.
I mean, first of all, that's incredible. How did we just find that?
It was all slated to come out as additional content following the release of the show. But on the eve of the finale, this happened.
Tonight, Robert Durst is behind bars, arrested overnight in the lobby of a New Orleans hotel. The investigation got a boost thanks to new evidence revealed in a documentary series that Durst willingly participated in.
Andrew was now going to be a witness in a murder trial. So all that extra material, it was all shelved. A lot of it became evidence, and it's been locked away until now. So on the podcast, we're going to be looking back at part one, and we're also going to watch part two together. That premieres April 21st on Max. We'll have director Andrew Jarecki joining to get into some of the juicier behind-the-scenes moments and things that didn't make it on screen. But before that, to kick things off, I have the honor of taking you back through those first 6 original episodes. So here we go. Chapter 1, A Body in the Bay. It's 2001 in Galveston, a city on the very southern edge of Texas.
A teenage boy fishing in the shallow waters off Galveston, Texas, stumbled on the gruesome remains of a murder.
The police are called, and the first officer who shows up, Detective Gary Jones, fishes out a collection of black plastic garbage bags.
We're trying to figure out what we had inside the bags. We just simply palpated the bags. We just felt them. We had what felt like arms and hands, fingers, a leg where you could feel the knee, the ankle, and the actual foot itself.
Alongside the gruesome body parts, in one of the trash bags, there's a clue.
One of the most important things that we found initially was a newspaper. We were able to read an address of 2213 Avenue K.
The police searched the rooming house on Avenue K. Detective Cody Kaslas finds out that the victim was the man who lived in apartment 1, Morris Black, an elderly drifter. The landlord says that someone mysterious lived across the hall.
And then apartment number 2, he said, was rented by a little old lady named Dorothy Siner, who was a mute female.
There are many questions about this mute female as detectives piece together that she's often away. And while she's gone, her nephew stays in the apartment.
Well, if she's got the money to travel all the time and she's gone for months on end, what's she doing living in this dump? I'm thinking, well, there's no Dorothy Siner. That's just a cover.
Detectives go through the building's garbage and find another name. This one on a receipt for a pair of eyeglasses. Robert Durst.
Now I'm thinking, who's Robert Durst? Still a bunch of question marks.
Kaslas takes the receipt to the eye clinic and asks them if they know who Robert Durst is.
the lady up front said, yeah, he was supposed to pick those glasses up on Friday. I'm thinking, Vegas wouldn't touch these odds this guy's going to show up. But I said, if he shows up, here's my card, here's my pager number. You know, I left.
A few days later, Detective Kaslas's pager goes off. It's the eye clinic. Mr. Durst is there for his glasses. Everyone will come to understand that he constantly defies expectations. Kaslas questions him after his arrest.
I explained to him, you've been arrested for, you know, homicide. Your bond has been set at $250,000. Do you have $250,000? And he just calmly looked at me and he goes, well, not on me.
Who the hell is this guy to give you that type of an answer?
I'm thinking, you know, what's going on here?
The police find out that Robert Durst is a millionaire and an heir to a massive real estate family in New York City. And he's also the longtime suspect in his wife's disappearance decades earlier.
Robert Durst first made headlines after he reported his wife missing in 1982. And to this day, the case remains unsolved. The family of Kathleen Durst from the beginning had said they believed Robert Durst was responsible.
And now, back in Texas, the question was, would Durst show up for his arraignment?
Robert was due to be in court at 10 a.m. And he was a no-show. He decided to run.
In the search for Robert Durst, a lawyer is asking him to surrender.
Robert, if you see this or hear this, please come home. You have loved ones who care about you here in New York.
After more than a month on the run, Bob's fugitive road trip comes to a somewhat unexpected conclusion.
58-year-old Robert Durst was arrested here at Wegmans Grocery Store in Hanover Township after allegedly trying to steal a hoagie.
I think we were kind of in the same boat as everybody else that had any knowledge of this case whatsoever. How in the hell could he have been that stupid?
This time he's arrested, his appearance has changed again. He's not dressed as a mute woman, but he has shaved his head and his eyebrows. Everyone's wondering, what's this guy thinking? And lucky for us, prison calls are recorded in Pennsylvania. And Bob and his current wife, yes, he is remarried, talk extensively on the phone.
It's going to be a media circus there.
I know, Lou. I'm trying not to think about it, and I'm trying not to plan what kind of look I should have on my face.
Yeah, I know.
Mean, am
yeah.
I supposed to be smiling, or am I supposed to be grim?
If you're thinking of expression, I would just have, like, as close to no expression as you
can. Yeah, that's what
have.
I think.
Yeah.
Whatever look Durst was going for, it comes across as relatively menacing, as bald Bob stares directly down the lens of the camera.
New York real estate heir Robert Durst will be turned over to Texas authorities this week. He faces charges in the dismemberment murder of a 71-year-old neighbor.
Robert Durst and his wife discuss how much money he's planning to spend on his defense attorneys.
In addition to the $600 for each of DeGaron and Ramsey, another
$300.
Okay. So that'll be $1,500 plus this $300 is $1,800. And God, I hope it gets me acquitted.
That's $1.8 million, and it does end up getting him acquitted. At his trial, Robert Durst will admit to chopping up the body of Morris Black, and he will still manage to be found not guilty. So here's where things take sort of a weird turn. If all that I just explained wasn't weird enough, in 2010, filmmaker Andrew Jarecki enters the story, because he makes a movie about Robert Durst called All Good Things.
All Good Things, a new feature film, premiered at the SVA Cinema in Chelsea. The film was inspired by one of the most notorious missing persons cases in New York City history.
Here's where I want to diverge from the TV show a little bit and share this interview that Andrew did when he was promoting The Jinx.
Before we made The Jinx, there was a whole other film, which was called All Good Things. And that was a narrative feature film that my partner and I had started writing a number of years before because we were interested in Bob Durst's story. And in that film, which we eventually made, Ryan Gosling plays a character based on Robert Durst. Kirsten Dunst plays his wife, and Frank Langella plays the father.
The reason I like this interview is it's kind of like a time capsule. It's Andrew before The Jinx comes out,
before Robert Durst is arrested. So his thoughts and comments are really in the moment. He doesn't know what's eventually going to happen as a result of him meeting Bob Durst.
This is a guy who had not talked about his life. For 30 years, every journalist and person had been trying to reach him and say, don't you think we could talk to you about what really happened in your life? And he always declined. And clearly something about All Good Things, something about our having made a film that showed that we really cared about the details of his life, that we weren't just going to represent him as a kind of one-dimensional, scary horror movie monster, but rather we're really going to show him as a person. Something about that is what drew him out, is what made him interested in talking to me to begin with.
So Bob sees some press about all the research that went into All Good Things, and he decides that he wants to see the film and speak with Andrew. But he doesn't know exactly how to get in touch with him. Eventually, he digs around, and he figures out that the distributor of All Good Things is Magnolia Pictures.
The way that we found out that Bob wanted to see the movie was kind of surprising. I was on the phone with the distributor of All Good Things one morning, and when we hang up the phone with each other, we usually would fall into Bob's voice, because if you know anything about or have listened to Bob's voice, it's a very characteristic voice, and so everybody sort of automatically falls into doing the voice. And so I remember hanging up with Eamon and saying to him, I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Eamon Bowles is the guy who runs Magnolia Pictures.
And then a few hours later, a call comes into Eamon's office, and his secretary picks up the phone, and the person says, this is Bob Durst. And she thinks it's a joke, and she knocks on Eamon's door and says, there's a Bob Durst on the phone. And he figures it's me, and he picks up the phone and immediately launches into some gag. And there's a long pause, and the person on the other end of the phone says, who am I speaking to? And Eamon realized at that moment that it was really Bob Durst. And he heard that Bob wanted to reach me, and he said that he would try to put us in touch. And then he called me, and he said, I just got a phone call from Bob Durst. Do you want to speak to him? I said, of course. So because I had some warning that Bob was trying to get in touch with me, I was able to start recording the very first phone call I ever had with him.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Durst.
Yes.
Hi, Andrew Jarecki.
Hi, Mr. Jarecki. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So I have an idea that would it make sense for, as in some capacity, there to be an interview with me related to what's in the movie?
So in the first phone call, it was really clear to me that Bob not only wanted to see the movie that we had made about his life, but that he also wanted to sort of feel me out. He knew some things that would intrigue me. I remember in one of the first phone calls, he said to me, well, I'm not surprised that my lawyer, Dick DeGuerin, wouldn't have told me that you had tried to reach out to me. He doesn't want me talking to some filmmaker.
Dick is very uninterested in me doing that.
Right.
How did you guys really get you acquitted? You didn't tell the truth, did you? Did you do this, 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 or this? The other thing, it sort of reads like the complete idiot guide to how to be a defendant at your own murder trial.
Right.
The back and forth of the lawyers and on and on and on and on like that. When do you bend the truth and when do you not tell the truth? And Who tells you whether you should do it this way or that way or the other way and like that?
That's a real key to Bob, right? He knows that if he calls a filmmaker and says, hey, you've been working on my story for years, and I just want to call you and mention that I lied to the jury in Galveston, it's not a surprise that that would pique my interest.
Well, I think it's a terrific idea. I mean, I do think that... you know, I was struggling, and I know my collaborators were struggling through the whole time, because we always wanted to get your perspective on the story, and my sense was that you would have a fascinating perspective on it and a necessary perspective on it.
Andrew and Bob met for the first time in the fall of 2010 at the breakfast room of the Peninsula Hotel in Beverly Hills.
It was all seemed very matter-of-fact at the time. You know, there was Bob. We had been looking at pictures of him, talking about him for 5 years. There he was, a little smaller than you might imagine, but very polite, very gracious, well-dressed, certainly not anybody you would notice, certainly not anybody that was out of place in the fancy breakfast room. And the breakfast was extremely polite. There was this weird moment at the handshake, because as normal as everything is, you know, you can't ignore the fact that you're shaking hands with this person who has dismembered another person. That was in my mind when I was shaking his hand. I remember that feeling. Otherwise, it was very normal in most ways.
After Bob sees the movie All Good Things, he agrees to participate in 3 days of interviews. The first day, Andrew and Bob will watch the movie and record a DVD commentary.
So the first thing we did when we got to Los Angeles was we arranged to sit down with Bob in a studio and to watch the movie All Good Things, our narrative feature, and while we were watching it, to do the commentary that you would find on a DVD. So I'm there talking about the choices that I've made in directing the movie. But strangely, I'm sitting next to the guy who's been accused of the murders that are portrayed in the movie, and he's getting a chance to weigh in as well. So it really was one of the strangest DVD extras of all time.
My name is Andrew Jarecki, and I'm the director of All Good Things. I'm sitting here with...
I am Robert Durst.
We're going to talk a little bit about the movie and the story that inspired it. Without Robert Durst, there would be no movie. So I'm curious about when you first heard that there was going to be a movie inspired by your life. When was the first time you remember hearing that?
Maybe 3-4 years ago. And my first thought about it was, well, they've done 97 other biographies. This is just another one.
But I was always thinking that there was a moment that was going to be more awkward or more difficult, because there's a kind of a famous scene that happened in Bob's life when his wife, Kathy, is being celebrated at a party because she has gotten into medical school and her family's around her. And Bob becomes uncomfortable, largely, I think, because there was a lot of attention on Kathy at that point.
I'll go start the car.
So there's an altercation between them, and he wants to leave and she doesn't.
Do whatever you want. I'm not leaving yet.
I would insist that we agree on how long we're going to stay. 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. We would always do a negotiation. When the time was up, I was ready to leave.
And it became very violent, because at one point he leaves and he goes and sits in the car and he smokes a joint. And he listens to the radio. I didn't know what it was going to be like for Bob to watch this scene. And then he really gets fed up that she's not doing what he says. And he barrels back into the house and walks across the party and grabs her by the hair and pulls her out of the house by her hair.
I assume that when Bob saw this vicious scene, he was going to try to deny that it happened. And he was going to say, well, Andrew, I can see that you decided to portray it this way in the movie for dramatic effect, but I would never have done something so violent as to pull my wife, Kathy, out of the house by her hair. Or he was going to say something like that. But that's not what he said.
Seen the story about the hair two different ways. One way, I drag her out of the house by her hair. The other way, I grab her hair and a big chunk comes out. Either one is close enough.
To watch him watch this film in which this beautiful girl gets dragged out of the party by her hair, and to see his reaction as such a calm and collected analysis of it was really striking to me. It told me a few things. Number one, that he was going to be pretty open, but it also told me that he was unaffected by the violence, that this is something that had happened in his life. Was obviously a giant event for her family, for her mother to see that, to see the level of violence in his relationship with his wife, was really striking. And to Bob, it was a scene. It was something that had happened. And it was something he described very calmly to me.
Another part of the film that Andrew thought might be difficult to watch with Bob was the scene where he comes home to find Morris Black, a man he would later admit to dismembering, in his Galveston apartment.
So this is a moment of that's been discussed a lot, or at least when you came back to your apartment and I think found Morris in your apartment. Do you remember that event?
I remember it very, very, very clearly. I remember the nightmare I went through over the next several days, trying to decide what to do, deciding I could not go to the police. Police aren't going to believe this. Nobody's going to believe that I came down here to Galveston, a rich guy, rented a $300 a month apartment disguised as a woman. And oh, and by the way, my neighbor is lying in my kitchen with a shot in the face from my gun.
There was a struggle, and then the gun went off.
There was a lot of discussion about the head.
Yeah, they never found the head. I have no idea why. I do know that there must have been 15 garbage bags full of body parts and other stuff with blood on it or whatever, and they found 12. And why they didn't find the other one, since they were all dumped in the same place, I have no idea.
But the head was with everything else.
Oh, it was in a garbage bin. It was in one of the garbage bags.
And that was a great beginning, in a way, to what ended up being, at that point, 3 days of interviews. So our first set of interviews with him, we drove from that studio over to the hotel in Santa Monica and sat down and began a conversation that was going to go on for 3 or 4 years before we finished the series.
It's a conversation that we will continue on the next episode of the Jinx podcast, when I take you back to Chapter 2, Poor Little Rich Boy. That's the episode where we get into Bob's childhood, and it's really the beginning of Andrew and Bob's interview.
Robert's hostility toward his father and toward his younger brother, which was of such intensity that it might constitute... I can't read that word. Can you read that word?
I think it's probably schizophrenia.
Yes, that's it. Schizophrenia.
We're also going to hear a really special conversation that Andrew had with Flo Jones, who was Robert Durst's secretary in the 1980s.
And did Bob ever raise his voice?
At times, his voice would go up, and he would get, wait a minute, I would say to him, Bob, who do you think you're talking to? I'm not your other secretary, I'm your secretary now. You don't talk to me that way.
So you were firm with him?
Oh, yes, he was firm with me, too. Believe me.
That's next time on the Jinx podcast, which is actually out now. Check it out.
Check it out. Check it out. Check it out.
The official Jinx podcast is hosted by me, Zach Stewart Pontier. It's produced by ZSP Media and Hit the Ground Running Films with HBO. Watch episodes of The Jinx and stream The Jinx Part 2 starting April 21st on Max. This episode was produced by Laura Newcomb. The rest of our team is Ethan Oberman, Naomi Brauner, and Ramoy Phillip. The supervising producer is Liz Stiles. This episode was edited by Simone Polanin. Mixing and engineering by Robin Shore. It was recorded at Relic Room in New York City. Music by Wes David Thordson. Additional music courtesy of HBO. The executive producers are Andrew Jarecki and me, Zach Stewart Pontier. Special thanks to Michael Gluckstadt, Ali Cohen, Aaron Kelly, and Savon Slater at HBO Podcasts. And the fabulous Jinx team, Sam Neve, Kyle Martin, Susan Lazarus, Annabelle White, Pedro Vital, Jesse Herman, Michele Zabarfian, Nako Narder, Charlotte Kaufman, and Richard Henkin. And thanks to Roe Dillon, George Vogel, Charlie Wessler, Nancy Jarecki, and Emily Wiedemann. And you. Thank you for listening and making it all the way through the credits. That's kind of incredible. As a little treat, here's more of Andrew and Bob from the All Good Things commentary.
The name of the movie is All Good Things. And, you know, that was the name of the store in Vermont.
Why did you name the store that?
Oh, I don't know how I came up with it. I came up with it and bounced it off Kathy, and she said, Graham, healthy food, health food, all good things. Almost like a slogan. Perfect name for a health food store.
Has anybody ever, asked you, or have you ever thought about the fact that that phrase often ends in the continuation, all good things must come to an end?
Well, they did. It just seemed like the right name.
One of the things that has come to an end is our commentary. I really can't tell you how much I appreciate your sitting here and going through parts of your life with me.
I enjoyed doing it.